Hello, and welcome back to Send Parenting Balance podcast. My name is Katie Walker, and we talk all things parenting children who have autism, ADHD, PDA, and any other associated mental health difficulties. Today's topic is going to be all about an EHCP. And a really big question that I often get is, should I get an EHCP? But also, how to manage our expectations of what an EHCP can hold for our children moving forward. And the answer to those questions has really mixed results depending on what kind of needs your children have. So let's break this down. Firstly, the wait list for the EHCP is very, very long right now. You're likely looking at 18 months or more in the process with it being turned down because there is no funding and therefore having to take it to a tribunal. The fight for an EHCP is likely going to be the biggest battle you have likely ever encountered. It's quite a stressful journey, but there's loads of people that can help you along your way, me included. It being turned down and refused is part of the process, and then such a high percentage, something like 96% of parents, then win the EHCP and it gets overturned at tribunal. So almost have it in your head that it's going to get turned down. We're going to go to tribunal with it. That's fine. Secondly, in an ideal world, school would be on board and agree with every need that you are trying to get help for. Of course, if school agrees and can see what it is you are explaining, the process is so much easier. Notice I said in an ideal world, of course, and I'm fully aware that we are not in an ideal world. In fact, further from it than we've ever been before in terms of support for our children with autism, ADHD, and/or PDA. However, just remember that you don't have to have school on board in order to apply for the EHCP. You can apply yourself and, like me, win. I've applied for two of my three children, both got turned down and both got overturned. And then with my daughter, that went through, which is fantastic. With my son, I'm still waiting for the tribunal date in a couple of weeks. Thirdly, and this is most importantly, it's important to think about what interventions or support you would like on the EHCP. What would help your child thrive through the school day? This can be a really tricky question to answer, especially if you're not entirely sure what would help and you need advice. And this is why I always say to parents and carers, try and complete your own care plan before embarking on an EHCP. A care plan is like an EHCP, but it's for you that you design. And it lists all of the needs that your child has, whether that's big needs or whether it's small needs, and everything in the middle. And all of the interventions and support that you put in place at home is listed on this care plan that can help with these needs. This can then be completed by school or with school, and you can show them what interventions you think work at home and therefore what needs to be mirrored in the school environment. And the school can then look at what support needs to go in place. It is almost an EHCP in itself, only it's not formalised and it's not a legal binding document because it's one that you have created. But it can be a great first step to use when applying for an EHCP. Or within that wait time of perhaps up to 18 months to get the EHCP started, because EHCP and the wait list for them is such a long time. If you'd like me to do this with you, it's inexpensive and can be found on the services page on my website, www.sendparentingbalance.com. Finally, if you do secure an EHCP, then this will stay with your child until they are through university and it gets updated every year, or at least it should do. However, budget cuts are meaning that these reviews are running slightly behind for many parents. But this means that regardless of what school or college or university your child attends, the EHCP is a legally binding document to ensure that your child gains the support and recognition that they require. And this means that if you find the school that you're currently in are really helpful, but it might have taken you 3 years of battling to get the support needs met, then when they move schools, you don't have to go through this battle again with a differing school or differing head teachers or differing staff. This EHCP can provide the foundation of reducing these battles because, should you ever be unhappy with the support offered to you or your child's needs, or your child's needs change, then you can just request an EHCP review and make changes moving forwards. So you're probably thinking so far, well, that's an awful lot of positives. So why not? Why not go for an EHCP? I'm going to share with you a personal story with my daughter who has an EHCP and how I wish that I had managed my expectations before receiving this EHCP, because I genuinely thought, I guess because society drums it into us, that an EHCP was like this magic wand, was like going to be the answer to all of my prayers. And as soon as she gets the HCP, she's going to be fine. Or as soon as she gets the HCP, there's going to be all this support open up for her. Or as soon as she gets this EHCP, she'll be able to access school full time. These were all thoughts that were going through my head. And I got so stuck in those loops that I just constantly was fighting for this EHCP. And then when the EHCP did come and my expectations weren't met, I was somewhat very confused and disappointed. So let me share with you my journey with Emily. At the moment, she's 14. When I applied for my daughter's EHCP, it was turned down. We went to tribunal and we won. Her EHCP process included assessments from speech and language therapists, occupational therapists, as well as educational psychologists, which was really helpful because this meant that her needs were fully assessed, not just by staff from school, but by every other professional. And they wrote their reports that all went in to form this EHCP. And that process, regardless of what was written in the EHCP, was so valuable. That was what opened up doors for me. And I learned so much about Emily in the process. And if you follow my TikToks, you'll already know that Emily was a child that was apparently fine. We all know that she wasn't in a school, but she had autism and ADHD. And once she was properly assessed by the correct professionals, it became known that actually Emily also had a severe social and communication disorder, severe anxiety, and dyslexia. And she was around about 4 academic years behind, something school had not picked up on because she was so good at masking and copying other people's work. Without these assessments, teachers were still able to say, but she's fine in school. Because, of course, teachers are experts in education and not mental health. So, for me, the process was worth every tear, every frustration, and every dead end meeting because I had those assessments from speech and language, occupational therapists, educational psychologists, and I really started to understand where Emily needed help. If your EHCP is going to tribunal, you can always request educational psychology. SALT assessments, which is speech and language and occupational therapy assessments, as part of the EHCP process. I have with my son, I'm still waiting for that to go to tribunal. I will, of course, keep you guys updated. But when I approached this about my daughter, I was awarded those assessments, which was fantastic. Whenever professionals ask me why I wanted those assessments, I would usually say something along the lines of, well, how can teaching staff who are professionals in education assess my child's needs when her needs are not clear? My child requires SALT, OT, and Ed Psych assessments to highlight what care needs are present and then what support can be put in place. So that's always a good phrase to use within your paperwork if you choose to go for an EHCP. However, once I was awarded the EHCP and all of these professionals had said everything about Emily and all of her needs and kind of what sort of things could be put into place to help, because the access to support within a mainstream system was so underfunded and staff undereducated, the EHCP in itself didn't open up as many doors as I was hoped that it was going to. So Emily's main problem educationally that she was approximately 4 years behind and dyslexic. And this meant that while she was in year seven, the work was just far too hard. But they were teaching her work that was aimed too high. And because she'd learned pattern recognition, she basically needed to go back to about year three. and restart it all. Relearn how to do multiplication, division, subtraction, relearn kind of all of the core foundation learning so that she could take on the harder stuff. But because she was in year seven, they wouldn't go back far enough for her. And so she wasn't learning how to properly do multiplication or division, and she was still just copying everybody else because she had absolutely no idea. So their version of easy work and my version of easy work was very, very different. They would offer to give her more time as part of an intervention, and actually more time wasn't helping, because what is more time if a child doesn't understand the work? More time just means they sit there for longer being anxious, or they sit there for longer not really knowing. It is very difficult when interventions say, we'll just give them an extra 20 minutes on their paper. And you kind of think to yourself, nope, actually, we need to go back and we need to restart some learning and move forwards from that. I've seen this done with children where they can go back way, way too easy and then build up again, because I've worked in schools and children catch up really quickly when you do this. And if they can just focus on the method and go right back, so it's really easy, what happens is it becomes so easy for them that they then build in their self-confidence and their self-esteem, and they feel great about themselves and they want to do more. And so children can catch up, even if they're 4 years behind, actually quite quickly, as long as you're focusing on taking it far enough back rather than just giving them more time and sticking with the harder questions. The reason that she was approximately 4 years behind was because she couldn't focus for longer than about 10 minutes due to her ADHD. She also had a communication disorder, so she needed things to be taught to her in a way that she understood, which was usually visually. And she had a social disorder, so being with 30 other children was really problematic for her and affected her ability to switch off from watching everybody else in the room. Being distracted from all the other children's behaviors or conversations, even just their body behaviors, but also having the confidence to put her hand up in front of all these other children to say, I don't understand, or can you just go through this with me again? It was much easier for her to stay quiet. She also had a sensory processing disorder, which meant that things like temperature, environmental noise, light, teachers' body behaviors and the constant change of teachers, particularly in secondary school, voice tone, class behavior management strategies, and her own internal demands, such as tiredness, hunger, feeling anxious, all put an extra layer of struggle on her. Lastly, with all of this going on, she also had associated anxiety, which then led to panic attacks. Which is why earlier on the podcast, I asked what interventions and needs you think your child has and would need to support you. Sometimes we believe in the HCP will somehow magically sort all of these needs, but if the problems are wrapped in social, communication, sensory, and environmental difficulties, then these are things that are trickier for anyone to change within the mainstream environment. The staff, no matter how wonderful they are, they may be able to change the work for you, but they can't change how many children are in the school. They can't change the behaviour management strategies. They can't change the noise levels. They can't change the strip lights, the temperature. They can't change the smells. They can't change the boisterousness of moving around between lessons. It can be very difficult for us to have those things written into an HCP because they're not things that are controllable. Yet for a lot of children with autism and ADHD, like my daughter, with social communication difficulties, environmental difficulties, sensory processing difficulties, and anxiety due to those things, it can be very difficult to help with these things. Doesn't matter how great the school is, how great the staff are, or how you can write into the HCP, your child can only access learning if those things are sorted, or at least intervene to help a little bit more. For my daughter, it was the environment that was hindering her catching up in that 4 years. Even funding her a full-time one-to-one to sit in a different room, a more controlled room, would have been ideal. But if we think about that, that also would have isolated her, and it would have likely have created further anxiety due to staff changes, because one-to-ones are very special in a child's eyes, but staff changes do happen and regularly. And the level of interaction and work for an hour of one-to-one would probably be exhausting for Emily. You see, in a classroom, a child likely only actually learns for about 20 minutes due to the behaviours of other children, the distractions, and the behaviour management techniques, such as line up or get this from the shelves or this from your bags, or and then they break down the lesson and they actually learn. Within an hour's lesson, with all that movement going on, there is actually only about 20 minutes of learning. So to have a child have one-to-one for a whole hour in a separate room can be very, very intense for a child. And we need to think about, okay, is that the intervention that I think would help? So with all of these contradictions and breaking down exactly what Emily's needs were and exactly what I thought that she needed from it, and realizing that maybe the HCP wasn't going to be the magic wand that I was hoping for, what did I do? Well, I got the HCP, as I've said, and I'm so glad I did because of all of the assessments that came with it. So I could see really clearly what Emily's needs were, and everything we achieved in the process was fantastic. But now we home educate because we can't change the environmental needs, the sensory processing needs, the anxiety due to those things, and then the social and communication difficulties due to just how many children are in the classes and in the school. Obviously, within the home education world, she gets to go to small groups with about eight others in the class. She gets all of those environmental factors are just taken away. You know, there's not the hustle and bustle of moving around between classes. There's not staff changes. There's only six to eight children in the class, so distractions are very minimal. They don't have to worry about wearing a school uniform, so they're not worrying about their internal demands of being uncomfortable. Too hot, too cold, they can sit by a window, open a window. They need the toilet, they don't have to put their hand up, they just go. There's so much more freedom. I mean, Emily can even eat while she's learning if she wants to. There's so much more freedom that a lot of this sensory processing and internal demands are completely gone, not due to having any interventions in, within the HCP, just due to the home education environment. And so she is thriving in this environment because her biggest problems were the environmental stuff and the sensory processing stuff and the social and communication stuff. And so this environment means that she hasn't got to deal with those things as hard, which means that that 4-year gap in her education is closing up nicely but naturally without too much effort. It's really important that in our minds, we really break down exactly what the separate needs are and what might be hindering our child's progress. Because just going for an EHCP and then thinking about what interventions a mainstream environment can provide is really important because we do have to remember that just adding 20 minutes on or doing small group work at the back of a class full of 30 may be a great intervention to have in comparison to not, but still might not cut it. Another example, my youngest son, age 7, he has autism, ADHD, and likely PDA. He also has a social and communication problem and an eating disorder, but he is clever academically. This means that the school, of course, say he's fine in school. And actually, in comparison to Emily, the school have even more evidence to suggest that he's fine in school. But he really struggles with similar aspects to Emily. He struggles with so social and communication. He struggles with the environment. He also struggles with the demands. He struggles socially and with communication. And from a sensory perspective, he finds it really difficult to make friends and keep friends because he doesn't really understand taking turns. He doesn't really have much empathy towards others. Finds it very difficult to play calmly because he gets so excited when he's got a best friend because it's so rare that he just gets really boisterous. Now, I can see why this is a problem. Now, what school have done is they've given him access to Lego therapy, which is a fantastic therapy group that runs over 6 weeks. And there's three people in the group. One person builds, one person reads the instructions, and the other person gets the bricks. And they have to work as a team to build something. And each week they take turns in changing their role. And this really helps them to communicate, to mix well with others, not get frustrated, and take turns. However, Lego therapy is a 6-week course. That's 1 hour a week to sit and play Lego with two other children. I love Lego therapy. I'm an absolute fan of it. But six 1 hour sessions is unlikely going to help or fix a social communication disorder linked to autism. Of course, I'm grateful that it will help within the 6 weeks that he's doing it, but long term, it's not going to make a massive difference. That's not to say we shouldn't do it in the first place. It's to say that we would likely need that every single week for a year. But trying to get that written in on the HCP is whole new grounds. Everything seems to be 6 week courses, 1 hour a week. So it can be very difficult to really sit down and go, okay, what does my child need? And can it even be met by mainstream? Another example again is my son, Harry. He, like I said before, has an eating disorder linked to autism. Now, CAMHS have told me to apply for any HCP, even if it's only in relevance to his eating disorder, because it's really important that his particular disorder is understood and that he can access his safe foods to keep him physically healthy. Now, his foods are very limited, and we have real difficulties at school because he doesn't like the school dinners. They're too varied. The environment is too busy. There's too many smells. There's too many demands of dinner ladies asking him to finish what's on his plate. The foods are touching. And he also doesn't like to eat cold food. So we are very stuck with Harry with his food intake. Now, CAMHS wrote to school on my behalf to explain the importance of creating a safe environment and only having access to his safe foods. However, from the school's perspective, the schools aren't actually in charge of the meals. It's the county council, in which I have spoken to, and I have been battling for now 3 years. Can you bear it? And we're still not quite meeting need. Now, this is due to funding issues and also understanding of disabilities from a county council level, not a school level. And so, although I've been battling this for years and years, the likelihood is his needs won't be met within mainstream education while his eating disorder is this way. And as much as I can be a one-man band and try and change things, even having an EHCP will not open doors for this particular issue because it's not the school that is in charge of the food. It's Hampshire County Council. So I guess CAMHS can issue all of the recommendations they think, but if the school is not funded or equipped, or Hampshire County Council is not funded or equipped to meet need, then they just can't. An EHCP likely won't change my battle with this, due to the fact of even having anyone at the county council in order to speak to that understands disabilities. It is very, very difficult, even if this was written into an EHCP, for them to meet the needs of a child that has avoidance and restrictive eating intake disorder when nobody knows what that is. One final example is for Emily. When she was in year seven, she hadn't attended school for 6 months and had school anxiety due to all of the issues I've already mentioned, and I was attending weekly grueling meetings trying to get understanding for her needs, even with the diagnosis and EHCP at this stage. But still being hit with the parental blame and the threats of court and attendance fines due to low attendance. Now, I was asking for all of these 6 months for Emily to attend a forest school because I felt like this would help with her anxiety. It would help her organize herself to want to leave the house. And although it wasn't education, it was something. And that may then lead to being brave enough to then obviously go to school. I was repeatedly told that her EHCP doesn't fund forest school. And at the final meeting I had with the school, which was 6 months later, and they were realizing that Emily was not sticking to all of the part-time interventions the school kept trying to bully us into, that they then said that maybe they could offer her forest school for a 6 week course for 2 hours a week. But there was a wait list of a further 6 months. And I couldn't help but ask, how does anyone think at this stage, by the time I would wait for a place to become available, 12 months after I had initially asked for forest school, for her to do 2 hours a week after a whole year out of school and a whole year of school anxiety, how does anyone in that room think that that is going to help? Her own trust in the system had been completely lost, and that wait time was basically a whole year of school. It was too little, too late. However, on paper, the school could write that they did indeed try to help and that they did indeed offer forest school, even though it was would have ended up being 12 months after I first requested it. I couldn't believe that a child with a diagnosis, with all of the issues that she had, with an EHCP, had been offered 2 hours of forest school once a week for 6 weeks, and that was the best that they could possibly do. And it apparently took an awful lot of funding. That to me sounds like madness. That is such a small thing. It's therefore really important that we ask ourselves the question, what is it we are hoping to achieve and what interventions do we need to help? And I'm going to go back to that's why a care plan is really important. Because if you're listening to this podcast and you're thinking, oh my goodness, Katie, how do I break this down? How do I even figure that out? I can help you. You literally need to just write down all of the needs the child has, every single one, from really tiny sensory aspects to really big aspects and everything in between. Then you write down what you think would help. And then you can look at what you'd be asking for an EHCP and if that can even be met within an EHCP so that you can manage your expectations. It might be that an EHCP might be able to meet half of them. And therefore, you think, well, actually, that's still worth it. I'm going to go for it. And therefore, that's great. But it just manages your own expectations so that you're not holding on for something that you're going to wait 18 months for, that your child has to wait 18 months for. And then you may likely feel let down or your child may. My best advice is to apply for the HCP, get on that waiting list, do it sooner rather than later because it takes so long. Write your care plan while you're in that process for yourself, but bear in mind that for the first time in a long time, we are living in an era where systems could not be more not linked up. That's in education, training, and/or funding. So try and manage your expectations moving forward. Sendias say that a need is a need without a diagnosis. And in fact, this is indeed the premise that I work alongside within my business, Send Parenting Balance. Due to waiting lists of up to 5 years for diagnosis, we cannot suggest that a need is not a need without a diagnosis. A child can get all the way through junior school without that need being recognised by CAMHS because the diagnosis wait list is so long. So it's not fair for a child not to have any intervention just because we don't have that piece of paper. But schools want the piece of paper due to the parental blame and stigma. And that means that if a child's in junior school year three, likelihood is they won't get a diagnosis until the child has actually left junior school, which then means the school haven't put anything in for that child to help them. That's not okay. CAMHS can write to schools, but tend not to because CAMHS are underfunded and crashing right now. If CAMHS do write to school, then they're unlikely aware of how the funding and services work at a mainstream school level. Hence why the example of Harry and the eating disorder battle that I was talking to you about has happened. So CAMHS think they are helping by writing to school, and in fact, they are helping me. They're holding my corner for me. But schools are just like, well, it's all very well that CAMHS have said that, but what are we supposed to do about that? We don't have the funding, or we don't have the this or the that. CAMHS are so oversubscribed that they're outsourcing other agencies to complete diagnosis. And they're not even really taking any late teen referrals due to the wait times being so long. Now, they keep saying to parents that schools should make reasonable adjustments, but schools are saying they can't make reasonable adjustments with no funding. So it's not actually any one agency's fault, but this lack of linking up, living in this era where systems could not be more not linked up, means that parents are circling around in a system that's really unhelpful and actually causes more stress and trauma rather than be helpful and support. Parents now are claiming DLA disability living allowance to pay for private assessments for diagnosis of autism and ADHD in the hope that this will give them the reasonable adjustments and support. However, there can still sometimes be some stigma around private assessments within mainstream schools, but this stigma is moving away because I do think people are understanding that the wait lists are so long, people are having to go private. And so, as parents, we think along the lines of step one diagnosis, step two EHCP. When you put the two together, this could be a 5 to 7 year journey for some families, and that doesn't even make mainstream school any more accessible or less problematic in the meantime. I would suggest that you empower yourselves against the broken system. Get on all the waiting lists and in the meantime, write your own care plan. And of course, as I've said before, I can help. Get a meeting with the Senko at school, take this care plan, requesting that they put all of the support and recognition in the places that you need, the places that you've highlighted, reminding them that a 5-year wait time for diagnosis is too long to just sit back and wait when the child has needs. I would then obtain the diagnosis in the HCP, but I would bear in mind that a mainstream system may never be up to scratch to meet expectations. So we should manage those expectations moving forward and really understand that yes, EHCPs do open a lot of doors through the process with other professionals making assessments. They can open up a lot of doors with offering reasonable adjustments, but we do have to bear in mind what those reasonable adjustments could be, what we're asking from mainstream, and is it even possible? I hope this podcast helped you and have some clearer understanding of EHCPs and their capabilities. I hope that some of you perhaps resonated with my story of Emily and her needs and have started asking yourself, okay, what would work for your child? I hope that some of you can see that not just awaiting a diagnosis and an EHCP doesn't always bring the level of support we hope, although it's a good procedure to do, but for different reasons to that the EHCP may be intended for. In short, go for the HCP, get on the waiting list, do your care plan in the meantime, and manage your expectations of what you think the school can do to help, and look at what list is longer. So, if on your care plan you have got loads of things, loads of interventions that are really helping, and mainstream can absolutely put those interventions in place, those reasonable adaptations, then your HCP will have a really good outcome. But if a lot of that is environmental, sensory processing, or social and communication, like with my daughter, still go for the HCP, but just bear in mind that you may have to manage your own expectations as to what those outcomes may be. I hope you enjoy the rest of your week. Thank you for joining me with this EHCP talk. And please remember, as always, that you can find me at www.sendparentingbalance.com. Please do reach out. I love to hear from you. And as always, this podcast is intended for education and entertainment purposes only, and is by no means a substitute for advice gained from a qualified counsellor or psychologist.